Welcome to the Engineering Culture Podcast. This is a new series focused on building and creating effective teams. The Engineering Culture Podcast joins the InfoQ Podcast, which now shifts its focus towards more architectural topics, as a regular series of podcasts brought to you by the engineers at InfoQ.com and the International Software Conferences, QCon. All podcasts at InfoQ are aimed squarely at software engineers, architects, and software leaders. My name is Wes Rice, and I'm the chair of QCon in San Francisco, London, and New York. This week's podcast is a chat with Phil Hack. Phil Hack is an engineering director at GitHub, where he's focused on software pushed mostly to the desktop. So he's shipping software like GitHub Desktop, GitHub Extensions for Visual Studio, and Atom, a hackable text editor built on top of Electron, which we'll talk a bit about here in this podcast. Before joining GitHub in 2011, Phil was and still is a prominent member of the .NET community. At Microsoft, he was core to shipping NuGet and ASP.NET, MVC.NET. Phil Hack will be speaking at QCon San Francisco, November 7th through 9th, in a track called Software Engineering Soft Skills. This is a really neat new track at QCon, and it's all about how to be an incredible software developer without really focusing on just the software side. It's focusing on the kind of the soft skills you need to be a developer. Phil's talk is called Social Coding for Effective Teams and Products. Phil, welcome to the InfoQ Podcast.
Thanks for having me.
Absolutely. So basically, as I was doing a bunch of research and trying to kind of figure out what's the best questions to ask you, I checked out your LinkedIn profile, and some of the specialties that you had highlighted there, I kind of expected. Software architecture, TDD, Transact SQL, C#, .NET, those kind of things. But you had some other ones there: good people skills, management, sane development practices, and sound methodologies. So why'd you pick those specialties?
I think as software developers, we tend to enjoy and get too focused on the nitty-gritty details of like objects, methods, monads. You know, we want to, you know, discuss and maybe argue about the minutiae a lot. But a lot of times as you scale out software development, scale out a project, the challenges, and PeopleWare, I believe, has a really great quote about that, which is that the big challenges of software are not technological, but they're sociological. How you work with other people, since that's a requirement of right now of building software, how you get the most out of other people, how you coordinate well, those are really important. Those are how you go from a one-person, you know, hobby project to, you know, a project that might have tens to 100 developers working on it. And so when you get to that scale, you know, how you work with other people, what kind of practices you do, and what approaches you take to manage that level of complexity become really important. And one thing that, you know, is really important to me is trying to take as much as possible an evidential approach to it, meaning, you know, looking at studies, looking at, you know, keeping careful track of what does work and what doesn't work. Unfortunately, there's not a lot of science and research in this area as much as there are in other engineering practices, for example. But, you know, like, it's worthwhile to take what we have and try it out and see if it actually works or if it's just conventional wisdom that doesn't make any difference.
One of the things you put here was sane development practices. What's a sane development practice?
I think when I wrote that, I think I was thinking a lot about build, like setting up a good build for a project. As an example, when I first got in the early days of my open source, you know, getting started with open source, I'd sometimes take a project down and, you know, I couldn't just hit F5 in Visual Studio or run a build script and have it all build and running. I'd have to, you know, configure about 20 to 30 different things and, you know, mess around with my environment. And, you know, I was really a big believer that, you know, if I clone a repository, or back then it was like, you know, get something from Subversion, like, you know, there should be maybe one or two steps before I have it up and running on my machine. And likewise, you know, having an automated build, you know, continuous integration, that sort of thing. To me, those help, you know, it's more about helping developers maintain their sanity, not just the process itself being sane, but that's also important.
It kind of dovetails right into the talk you're going to do at QCon San Francisco. That talk is coding, or social coding for effective teams and products. Can you talk a bit about what you're planning there?
Yeah, you know, it's really interesting. This is in a track called Soft Skills, but the irony is that soft skills are actually among the hardest skills to learn and apply in the day-to-day life. And what I found is, as I mentioned earlier, like the big problems we have are sociological. And a lot of times, I think engineers and companies don't pay enough attention to those challenges and problems. They think, well, if we adopt containers, if we adopt this, if we adopt that, these technical practices, all our problems will be solved. And a lot of times, where the root problem is, like how your people are interacting with each other and how they're working together. And so in this talk, I want to cover some of my personal lessons as well as some of the research that backs those personal lessons. To note that, this isn't just stuff where it's like this feel good, come around a campfire, kumbaya type of thing, but that there's actually a lot of research that shows certain things make for more effective teams. Just to give one example, there's this trend right now to talk a lot about diversity and inclusion for software engineering teams. And there's a backlash that you can often hear from, hardcore tech types who are like, hey, I just want to focus on the code. Like, none of that stuff matters. This is just social justice warriors running amok. And I think, the reality is, well, if you actually want to get hardcore about it, let's look at the research and what does the research show and demonstrate. And the research so far shows that teams that are more diverse are more effective. There's one that showed, like, boards of companies that are more diverse have higher profit and revenue on average, or teams that are engineering teams that have a greater diversity of people are more productive. So, there's more research to be done, but I mean, so far, it's while I personally may feel like the social justice angle is important in its own right and enough for me, I think for those who feel like, oh, this is a distraction, the research is pretty clear so far.
Let's shift a little bit and kind of back up. So I mentioned kind of in the intro that you came from Microsoft and you talked about it like in your career of open source software, you've kind of gone from kind of the old way, the traditional way of doing software, kind of inside the firewall, and now to GitHub where things are literally done outside the firewall. What's that shift been like for you from going from, say, Microsoft where things were done kind of the old way, at least at one point, to how it's being done today?
It's interesting because it, fortunately for me, it hasn't been too big of a shift in that regard because the projects that I worked on were open source. So like my main project at Microsoft was ASP.NET MVC, and in my time there, I, among many others, fought to make it open source. And we were very lucky to have a general manager at the time who later became a VP and now is, reports directly to the CEO there, Scott Guthrie, who was very supportive of that effort. And in fact, he was a key driver as well. And because he understood the future of Microsoft really depended on it embracing and understanding open source. So ASP.NET MVC was open source. And then NuGet, the package manager that I was involved with, was open source pretty much from the beginning. And so from that perspective, it took a long time before we could actually, for example, accept contributions from the public, but we got to that point before I left Microsoft. So in that regard, it's very similar to the work I do at GitHub. I think the primary difference was, moving from a company of 100,000 to, at the time, a company of around, I don't know, 30 to 50. That was probably the biggest change where, just the sheer scope and magnitude of Microsoft versus like a small, scrappy company, which has, since grown and we're now about 600 employees. And so it's been really excited to kind of be at GitHub and all these different stages of a company's growth.
Yes, but MVC.NET wasn't open from the beginning, right? It was that always the plan for it to be fully open source, or did you have to go through, I guess, some cultural changes to get to that point?
It was always my plan, but yeah, we it was not open source during the development of it. I believe, oh, man, this is ancient history now.
Yeah, it is.
I believe like by 1.0 we were able to release it under the MSPL license. So that it was a big cultural change. For example, we would have to do these insane IP reviews, that cost a lot of money every single time we did any kind of release of the code. And I think they've really since then streamlined the process, made it more manageable. Also, at the time we had to release things on CodePlex, and I really wanted to start, with NuGet, I wanted to really start moving things to GitHub because that's where the larger developer community was. And one of my goals had been to make the stuff that we worked on there, ASP.NET MVC and NuGet, appeal to the broader engineering and developer environment, not just the Microsoft fandom, so to speak.
So, what tips do you have for some folks out there who may be trying to go through the same thing that may not be actually using or pushing out open source software, but they want to, that particular product that they have that the company is keeping closely held? Any tips, any advice that you might give them?
Yeah, I mean, start small. I think it's probably the type of advice you give with almost any new endeavor. Pick something that's kind of standalone and test the waters. Learn from the examples that companies like Microsoft and Apple, who's released Swift, and companies like GitHub, who've released a lot of open source software as well, that it's there's a lot of lessons to be learned from how they do it. For example, ideally, if it's something that you think you'll get a lot of traction on, you don't want to just toss it over the wall and then ignore all the incoming feedback. It will require some amount of, community management and extra work to manage all the incoming, but I think that has a payout. One of the teams that I work with at GitHub is the Atom team, and that, a text editor is the kind of thing that like nearly everyone has an opinion on. So it's probably more than a full-time job to just manage the incoming issues that are coming in and the incoming pull requests. And so I don't know if we're yet managing Atom in the way that we would recommend to everyone, but we're striving to get there. It's
Right.
grown so quickly. That we need to put maybe more effort and figure out more ways of managing that incoming load.
Yeah. Wait, when you left, was NuGet on CodePlex or was it on GitHub?
Interestingly enough, NuGet, the core Visual Studio extension and the core libraries were on CodePlex, but the website, NuGet server, was on GitHub and our documentation.
Did you ever imagine when you left Microsoft that ASP.NET would be on GitHub?
I imagined it. It was more like I hoped for it, but I thought this was the type of thing that folks like me and Hanselman and Scott Hunter were wanting to have happen. But the extent and the quickness that it happened, I think that is the surprising aspect to me because I was there 4 years and it took a lot of work just to get from one place to another, but it felt like the progression of open source at Microsoft was like sort of like the hockey stick. It's like a exponential growth type thing.
Yeah.
I mean, just the other day, PowerShell was released on GitHub as a cross-platform, scripting
Wow,
tool,
yeah.
and I was like, wow! Like I always thought PowerShell so and tied to Windows. I mean, it was in the name, Windows PowerShell. But it occurred to me like once they made cross-platform .NET, like .NET Core, that opened the door for things like PowerShell, which is based on streaming objects rather than byte streams. And so yeah, it makes sense that they now have the ability to make that open source.
So let's fast forward up to, I guess, what, 4 or 5 years ago now, when you moved to GitHub. So you talked about Atom a bit. Atom's kind of an interesting toolkit. So it's JavaScript, HTML, CSS, right? So tell us a bit about Atom.
Yeah, so Atom, the goal of Atom was to be the most hackable text editor. I think this was a vision that Chris Wanstrath, our CEO, had for a long time. Looking at Emacs, for example, VI, these things are extendable, but they often you have to extend them with a technology that you might not already be familiar with. And so the thinking goes, well, what technology is nearly every developer likely to be somewhat familiar with? JavaScript, CSS, HTML. So imagine that we can build a text editor where your existing web development skills, since that's probably the largest area of software development there is right now, what if your web development skills could be applied and to extend and hack your text editor? How cool would that be? And so we've embarked on that mission because we think that Adam will help appeal to a large subsection of engineers. And it's been really exciting. I wrote a blog post recently about my dumb little Atom package where every time you save a file, it gives you a little bit of encouragement. Like, hey, good job. Wonderful save. And I have a little emoji in there. But it was, it's actually gives me a smile every time I use it. And it was funny, like, because it's fun in terms of like, wow, like this is so easy to write. I still, you still have to learn like how the Atom API is put together a little bit, but like in terms of the UI and stuff, it's like, oh, this is a div and I'm going to apply some CSS styling to it. And, like this feels familiar. And so, if you haven't tried Atom, I definitely encourage you trying it out and, try extending it. It's really cool.
Yeah, I haven't tried Atom specifically, but this morning, just to kind of get prepped to chat with you, I pulled down Electron and did some builds, and I was pretty impressed with it. It was cool. It reminded me of like I don't know, Cordova for the desktops that we could build cross-platform apps.
Yeah, and so Electron actually was sort of extracted from Atom and turned into its own project. I mean, it was originally called the Atom Shell, and then we realized that caused a lot of confusion, so we called it Electron. So now you got Atom, you got Electron. You can sense a theme here.
Yeah, I get it. I got
I don't need to spell it out right now. Maybe we should call it Lepton, but.
it.
In any case, so Electron has become an important community in its own right. We have Slack is built on Electron, the client. NewClide, the Facebook IDE, is built on Electron. Actually, that's actually built on Atom as well. There's a bunch of other stuff. Oh, Visual Studio Code is built on Electron. So a lot of companies, we're like every day we're learning about new companies, big companies even that you've probably heard of that are using Electron as a foundation for cross-platform applications, Mac, Windows, Linux. And the same kind of theme applies in terms of Atom applica or Electron applications are effectively like Node applications. That run in this client shell. So it's based on Chromium, and Node and NPM are all kind of in there. And the NPM part's really interesting because that means that any of these existing NPM modules out there, of which there are a huge number of packages, you can pull those in to help build your, desktop application. And so that's a powerful development environment for building desktop applications.
Yeah, it was pretty cool. I was impressed. I didn't realize the Slack client was built with it until I started getting into it and playing with it.
One of the lead engineers there, Paul Betts, was originally from GitHub and he used to work with me, and he was heavily involved in the Electron community.
Yeah, it's pretty cool. Definitely recommend folks to take a look at it. It was easy, pretty easy. I think going back to what you said right at the very beginning, I think it took me all of about four commands to get everything up and running with a little demo app. It's pretty nice.
Yeah, and it's nice that you can leverage your web development skills to build desktop apps. And it's interesting because I think this idea has been around for a very long time, but we're getting, it's like this is the time where like the tools have caught up and the performance has caught up where this is a viable approach for a nice cross-platform desktop application.
There's a lot of developers that at some point make a decision to move into management. What kind of advice do you have for a developer who is kind of faced with the opportunity to move into management? What kind of risks and challenges did you experience?
Yes, it's interesting because I think I've done management before, and when I joined GitHub, I was really excited to be an individual contributor engineer again. And the way I kind of fell into it was that at one point GitHub decided that we needed managers, because when I joined, we didn't even have managers. And it was one of those things where it was like, well, no one else on my team has experience as being a manager, and they're wary of someone outside coming in as a manager, so I guess I volunteer. So the advice I would give is consider it a discipline, much like you would consider an engineer or a DBA or any other technical field. It's not something that you just, I mean, you can do a decent job of just winging it, but it is a discipline. And that means that there's work to be done in terms of brushing up on skills and like domain-specific knowledge. One example, like probably, if I was to tell you one thing to learn how to do well, it would be holding weekly one-on-ones with, everyone that you manage. And I think that has been the most important lesson for me personally, because one of the first things you really want to do is to build and develop trust between you and each person you work with on an individual one-to-one basis. And so, doing one-on-ones effectively means that it's not a status update. It's really a time for them to tell you what's on their mind, what's important to them, and for you to listen. And then, I had this whole approach to it that I learned from this really great podcast called the Manager Tools podcast. But basically, it's like, the ones I have are like 30 minutes, and it's usually either half and half, like what they want to talk about, what I want to talk about, or 10, 10, 10, where it's what they want to talk about, what I want to talk about, and then talking about their future.
Oh,
But the
nice.
important thing is it always starts with them, and it's always, they sort of set the agenda. And the impact of that is over time, like as you get to know each other as people, as individuals. Like if they want to spend the whole 30 minutes, talking about their cats, then, for the first few times, like by all means, talk about their cats. The important thing is that you develop a relationship where you feel like they can trust you, you can trust them, and that goes a long way to building a team that's effective. Because if I trust that you're coming from the right place and your opinions, like we can be candid with each other, we can have strong debates, but know that it's coming from a good place, that there isn't a political agenda involved, things like that. When you don't have that trust and you try to make decisions, for example, that may be challenging. It can go really bad. And I've learned that from experience as well.
Great advice. Absolutely great advice. So you just mentioned another thing that's a great question, and that is building great teams. So what, particularly for the developer who becomes a manager, what types of tips, tricks, what types of things do you do at GitHub to actually build the kind of team that you need to develop modern software?
Well, at GitHub, one of the things we've been focusing a lot on are, so I mentioned one-on-ones and building trust. Like that, to me, that comes first. The next part is building a culture that can deliver feedback well. And delivering feedback is surprisingly challenging, or doing it well at least, right? Like saying you're an idiot, why would you do something like that, for example. It turns out that's not very effective. Surprisingly, right? It's like, why don't these idiots just know that this is the right way? Like that's not a good way to deliver feedback. Only delivering feedback when someone does something wrong, as opposed to when they do something right. That's not very effective, right? So, like, learning how to deliver feedback where it's consistent, it's regular, it's done well, it's positive, and like constructive, like all these things are really important. Because when you have a team that feels comfortable and safe in delivering candid feedback to each other, then the team has the ability to constantly improve. And I think, that's the second factor. There's trust, and then there's team that can constantly improve. And I think feedback is another mechanism for doing that.
There's another trend that I've heard a lot of discussion about coming from folks out of the valley, and it's been how do you grow good managers? You mentioned you have three, possibly four direct reports that are managers. How do you hire good managers? How do you grow managers? Are they developers turn managers, or is there another approach that works best? What are your thoughts?
That's a really great question. I think so. At GitHub, the approach we're taking right now with managers is that our managers are technical leaders, and so they in effect are like senior level engineers who are have some personnel management responsibilities. And this is kind of a different tack than I've taken in the past, but I think it's, so far it's working out well. So we try to have managers manage teams that are about 4 to 6 in size. They may well have a report who is or someone they manage who is a strong technical leader, and maybe they are the technical leader of the project. But ideally, the manager is also seen as a technical leader. And in this case, we had this like kind of rough rubric. Like they'll spend 80% of their time in sort of the technical stuff, and 20% of their time in the personnel management side of things,
Oh, wow.
more or less. But they're supported by a director who has the inverse of that. So like I'll spend 80% of my time in personnel, focused thing, and 20% in technical direction. I think the reality is more like for me, like 40, 40, 40. So, but for yeah, so so we're trying to develop both folks who are strong technical leaders, but also have a lot of empathy and can really coach and help people to grow. Because one of the things we found is that often for engineers, folks who are effective coaches are ones that they look up to as strong technical leaders,
Yeah,
right? And so it's really
absolutely.
hard to have someone who isn't really technical but is a great personnel manager come in and coach an engineer, because they're like, well, like you don't have a whole lot to offer me right now. And so that's the approach we're taking. One of the things I really like about GitHub is if an approach isn't working, we're willing to tweak it, change it, and try something different.
Very nice. If you want to learn more on soft skills for developers and how you might apply them in your work, come see Phil live in San Francisco, November 7th through 9th at QCon San Francisco, in his talk, Social Coding for Effective Teams and Products.